From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Wayne County Prosecutor and Fair Michigan join together to investigate and prosecute crimes committed against people who are LGBTQ.
I think people are at least beginning to realize that everybody deserves justice.
At least I can say, well, maybe the state of Michigan doesn't care about you, but Wayne County does.
Slowing auto sales have investors watching the Detroit Three.
There's a belief that they may not be able to manage a downturn. And they've basically been saying, yes, we can. So now they're going to get a chance to prove it.
A push to put voters in charge of drawing legislative districts, not politicians.
Letting it be a fair and transparent process that helps us have our votes counted instead of being manipulated.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program,
the message is the state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're gay. The state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're trans. And the thing that has been of such great comfort to me is at least I can say, well, maybe the state of Michigan doesn't care about you, but Wayne County does.
The Fair Michigan Justice Project, marking a new initiative to find and prosecute hate crimes committed against the LGBTQ community. Then a grassroots group wants to overhaul Michigan's redistricting process.
We see that people are sick of the status quo and that they see that there's a problem and that they can extend over personal political beliefs to want to do something that's better.
More on that later in the hour. But first, can you teach an old dog new tricks? In this case, the old dog is the Detroit Three automakers. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House thinks we are about to find out, for better or for worse. Daniel, you say the Detroit Three's complaint of we don't get no respect is about to be tested. How so?
Well, you know, car sales, auto sales, I should say more broadly, are down for six consecutive months over last year, which was a record year. But already you got Wall Street saying, oh, things are slowing down, things are slowing down. Well, one of the complaints about or criticisms of the Detroit automakers has been, despite the fact that they're making, particularly General Motors and Ford, billions in their home market, there's a belief that they may not be able to manage a downturn. And they've basically been saying, yes, we can. So now they're going to get a chance to prove it. I think this slowdown is probably going to continue. It's coming off a very high mark, no question about it, record years. We've gotten a little spoiled. We've had the longest sales expansion in the last 7 years since the 1960s. We've never seen anything like this before. It was going to have to end at some point or slow down, and it is. But I think there's a lot of things that are changing in this marketplace. You've got somebody like Elon Musk's Tesla that this month is going to be launching his first volume electric car. A lot of anticipation in that vehicle. General Motors already has its Chevrolet Bolt all electric out in U.S. showrooms, and it's going to be proliferating into more showrooms over the coming months. But you've got a lot of pieces and a lot of things spinning at the same time, and certainly the international environment in Asia with Korea and North Korea, how China, what role China will play, how the President of the United States will pressure China, what impact that may have on various industries, including the auto industry, I think is yet to be played out.
Quite a laundry list. You and I have talked about the fact that investors love Tesla to the point where it's valued more highly than GM or Ford, even as GM and Ford, as you say, are making boatloads of money. Such a double standard. So clearly profits aren't enough. So what are the best ways the Detroit Three can prove that, hey, yeah, you can teach an old dog new tricks? I mean, more to the point, what do investors need to see as sales slow down or not see?
Well, I think one of the things they need to see is something you're already seeing from General Motors particularly, which is we are going to maximize profitability in areas where we can make money. That's why you are seeing them sell off their European operations. They believe that over the longer term, the calls for capital into Europe will be much greater than any return they're going to get out of it. So as a result, I think you see them focusing on the United States, focusing on areas like pickups and SUVs in a low gas price market. They get criticized by a lot of the sanctimonious sides who say, oh, well, look at Detroit. They're just building more trucks and SUVs. Look, the market is buying them. The market is buying them at all different sizes. It is a misnomer and, frankly, a lie to suggest that all pickups and SUVs are all big gas guzzlers. They're not. General Motors has come in with a midsize pickup truck. Ford is bringing back the Ford Ranger. That's an acknowledgement that there's demand in the marketplace for a smaller pickup truck with smaller displacement and greater fuel economy. You already see one of the fastest growing segments. Many of your listeners know things like the Ford Escape or the Chevy Equinox or the Honda CR-V or the Toyota RAV4. These are compact utility vehicles that give the driver a lot more utility in terms of how they can use that vehicle, but they get some of the same fuel economy that you would have gotten out of a compact car. So I think that one of the things you got to look at is where are they maximizing profitability? Two, are they making hard calls in markets where they are not going to make money and pulling out of various parts of the world? General Motors is clearly leading in that. I think a lot of people are scratching their head because they're being so aggressive about it. My reporting on that suggests that they have kind of done what they're going to do for the time being now, that there isn't another shoe or two to drop as far as GM is concerned, although I would expect to see something like that happen with Ford. And I think thirdly, despite the fact that electric vehicles only account for about 2% of sales in the United States, I think a lot of regulatory pressure is pushing these companies to move ahead with the bets that they're placing on electrification. And if they don't get into that game, I think they're going to be punished in the marketplace as well. So, you know, Tesla is an all-electric company, and it's a longer-term play, and investors are betting that the market is going to go all-electric. I think the jury is clearly still out on that. What major companies like the Detroit Three are going to have to do is placing bets on traditional internal combustion engines and traditional vehicles as we know them, and also some things that are bets on the future that are electrified. And they're going to have to be able to toggle between the two. And I think how they manage that going forward is going to be something that investors are going to look at and look at closely. Finally, is going to be, is this company able to deliver, Tesla, on volume manufacturing? I think Elon Musk certainly is signaling that he thinks that's no problem. But these companies, all of them, I mean, the Japanese, the Germans, the Americans, the French, they've been building in volume for decades. And they've been refining how they do that and maximizing this. This is an all new thing for a company like this. So how they are able to make that transition is going to go a long way to seeing if they really are the smart bet that people think they are.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
Unemployment numbers in the U.S. seem to be looking good, but they don't tell the whole story. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff thinks a more telling economic indicator is just which American jobs are going unfilled.
A very strange article in the New York Times caught my eye the other day. It noted that while unemployment has fallen to the lowest point in a quarter of a century, that's actually an ominous sign of trouble ahead. The article used employment data to suggest that while almost everyone who wants to be employed is currently employed, millions of strategically essential jobs are going unfilled. More so, the new xenophobia is making it increasingly difficult to import talent from other countries. Nowhere is the talent gap more challenging than in the automotive industry. A recent Business Week story says it all. Detroit is trying really hard to woo young workers. It points out that the lack of qualified new hires has become so pressing that it's now part of the weekly executive briefing at General Motors. At this year's Mackinac Policy Conference, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder highlighted the need to train, recruit, and retain proficient young engineers and other professionals if Detroit-based companies hope to win the connected technology and autonomous vehicle race. As the baby boomers who created the post-war economy retire in ever-increasing numbers, the ramifications are clear and unsettling. If America hopes to keep its prized position as the innovation leader of the world in key industries such as automotive and aerospace, and keep the standard of living that goes with them, it had better find a way to quickly develop the competencies required to advance technologies faster than its competitors. That brings us to the specter of a new innovation leader, China. Less than 3 years ago, then Vice President Joe Biden quipped, "I challenge you, name me one innovative project, one innovative change, one innovative product that has come out of China." Well, anyone who attended this year's Consumer Electronics Show can probably name a dozen. Industrial robots, gigantic 3D printers, and various types of consumer prosthetics, to name just a few. And those aren't even close to the whole story. Chinese advances in material science, naval engineering, and deep space satellite killers are currently considered issues of national security. In fact, during the past 3 years, China's expenditures for research and development and the patents award for innovations have significantly outpaced our own. In their book, China's Next Strategic Advantage, From Imitation to Innovation, professors George Yip and Bruce McKern intimate that it may already be too late for the U.S. to regain its position as first in class. Perhaps the most telling change of fortunes recently occurred when President Trump decided to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Within the week, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang declared that China was not only ready to meet its obligations, but would lead world efforts to reduce global warming. While China is widely known to be one of the most polluted countries on the planet, what is often overlooked is that it is clearly a global leader in clean technology. Premier Li knows that the Paris Climate Agreement is good for business, and China has the young and skilled workforce capable of taking advantage of the situation. As we move towards a populist ethos, it's easy to forget the fact that high wages accompany high skills. Full employment with declining wages in lagging industries is a poor bellwether for our economic prospects. The actions of our government are of little consequence if we lack the talent and culture to participate in the highly competitive and extremely lucrative world of innovation. It's time we move beyond measuring what percentage of us have jobs and look at the more telling indicator, the number of jobs that have gone unfilled because of a lack of qualified applicants. This is the innovation gap. Once we look at it this way, we could realistically address the difficult issues of education and immigration that will determine our fortunes in the not-so-distant future.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You'll find his essay on The Next Idea link at michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A new art exhibition opening this Saturday at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn can give us fresh insight into Saudi Arabia. Epicenter X, Saudi Contemporary Art, features installations in various mediums from a large group of Saudi artists. Organizers are hoping the show might break down some of the stereotypes that we might have about Saudi Arabia. With us now is Devin Achman, who's director of the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. It's always good to see you, Devin. Welcome.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on the show.
How rare is it for an exhibition this large of Saudi art to be mounted here in the U.S.?
It's actually quite rare. There have only been a handful of exhibitions here so far in the U.S. that look at contemporary Saudi art practice. There have been a handful of exhibits so far in the U.S. Most recently, there had been one at the Station Museum in Texas and a couple solo shows, one at the Smithsonian, one at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. So we're excited to be among the first presenters of Saudi art.
Why was this the right time, do you think, for the museum to mount this exhibition?
Well, clearly there's been a lot happening, both in the U.S. and abroad. In the U.S., obviously our president was just there. But in Saudi Arabia, much has been changing. So last year, the Saudis announced a new vision for their country, the 2030 plan. And they're looking broadly at their economy and society. And this exhibit, through the lens of artists, is really taking a critical examination of that. And for many in the U.S., they're unaware of both the topics that are being explored, but the fact that there is a contemporary art scene in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested about the emerging art scene in Saudi Arabia and how it compares to other established art centers in the Arab world.
Well, when people think about art in the Arab world, especially contemporary practice, most people tend to think about places like Beirut, Cairo, Abu Dhabi, Dubai. But Saudi Arabia is not one of those locations. And
why do you think that is?
Well, it's a very unfamiliar place for a lot of Americans. Despite the fact that it's such a prominent ally of the U.S., we tend to think of Saudi Arabia merely through the political lens, and most of the dialogue tends to be through the media. We don't have much of an understanding just of Saudi Arabia in general. I can honestly say I was actually one of those people as well. And I was in Saudi Arabia recently meeting with an artist that we're hosting through a separate project, an artist residency program, and had the opportunity to experience what they call 2139, which is essentially this massive art week in Jeddah. And through that, I immersed myself in a lot of this contemporary practice and began to realize that not only were there some very prominent established artists in Saudi Arabia, but there's a booming emerging art scene. And we knew that this story had to be explored, and we wanted to bring that show to the U.S.
How many artists?
In sum, there's approximately 40, but of that, about 50% of that is a group of women who collaborated on a series of murals. Now, these murals are representative of a style that's found in the southwest portion of Saudi Arabia by the Red Sea and near the Yemen border. And these murals are a traditional practice that are typically adorned on interior walls of homes and courtyards. So it's a nice juxtaposition between this traditional practice with the contemporary practice. What's more, it's really great to see that women are part of this artistic practice. And I think, again, in our society, we tend to think of, women's roles in Saudi Arabia being a little less prominent, to say the least.
That's a very fair statement, if not outright repressed. Yes, I think that's the common.
It's wonderful to elevate their story as well.
Now, what are some of the themes or that this exhibit explores or stories it tells?
There's quite a bit happening in this exhibit. There are explorations of urbanization that's taking place, especially in significant locations like Mecca, the holy city of Mecca. A lot of development there, a lot of plans for cultural tourism, yet this very, very significant holy site for the Muslim community. Looking at the role of a religion in society, looking at relationships between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and places like the United States. So a myriad representation of ideas that are taking place, and some of these are challenging. I think for a lot of Americans that see this, they'd be surprised to see such complex viewpoints being expressed in this exhibition.
I dare say that there are impressions of Saudi Arabia, as we talk right now, jumping into people's minds about it being a repressive society. Certainly human rights activists are following it closely. I know the Human Rights Watch World Report for 2017 talks about, Saudi strikes in Yemen that have killed and injured thousands of civilians. And, of course, peaceful dissidents are being arrested and tried and put into long prison sentences. Certainly the discrimination against women and religious minorities. Do these issues get explored at all in these pieces?
Not so much those issues. There are very complex issues on many different topics that are relevant to society. For us, obviously, we're not looking at this exhibition in terms of a political statement. We're not looking at this to make a statement in and of itself. For us, this is more about the role of artists in society. And as an institution, our institution, since our inception in 2005, we've really tried to position both the museum and our neighboring annex as a place to have critical dialogues, looking at topics that are impacting our community both here and abroad. So for us, this is about providing space and allowing the art to speak and for our U.S. audiences to interact with that.
Speaking of a U.S. audience, can someone who is totally unfamiliar with Saudi culture and society be able to walk in and get these works?
Absolutely. There are very familiar themes. I think that they're universal themes, themes that are quite relevant happening locally. I was just actually thinking about so many issues and things that are taking place this summer here. We have the 50th anniversary of the Detroit Rebellion. We have the Detroit Design Festival coming up. We actually have the annual Hajj taking place during this exhibit. We have the 16th anniversary of 9/11 happening during this exhibition, and it's only up for 2 months. So there is so much that's happening while this exhibition's up, and the content within it is so timely and in many ways universal that I think just about anyone who enters the gallery will be able to connect with this work.
What kinds of misconceptions do you often hear about Saudi Arabia? As you go around and meet people in Michigan, what are you hoping people might get out of this exhibit to address these misconceptions?
Well, I think in general, just what's happening in Saudi Arabia. Again, Saudi Arabia is a society that's actually quite young right now. And like many societies throughout the world, they're more and more digitally connected. So ideas are flowing and being exchanged in new ways. The fact that there is such a diversity of viewpoints within a society. And again, looking at the role of an artist as essentially a chronicler of expression in our times and elevating those stories and putting forth those stories for audiences to see. So I think this exhibit will successfully allow that for visitors. And I think for many who experience this work, they'll come away with some new insights into both Saudi, what's happening in the kingdom right now, and also the relationship between the kingdom and the U.S.
Because we're getting that insider's view.
Yes,
not
absolutely.
Looking at it through a political lens.
Absolutely.
So it opens on Saturday. How long does it last?
Up until October 1st.
So you've got a good stretch to get to Dearborn. Now you can get information on Epicenter X and the other things happening at the Arab American National Museum by going to their website, arabamericanmuseum.org. That's arabamericanmuseum.org. Devin Achman, it's always good to see you. Thanks so much for being
with us.
Thanks so much. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Power to the people. That slogan, so widely used in the 60s, is the driving force behind a push to change the way Michigan draws its legislative and congressional districts. The group Voters Not Politicians has firmed up the language for a voter petition to put a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot for November 2018, an amendment that would overhaul Michigan's redistricting process. Katie Fahey is the president of Voters Not Politicians. The group's slogan is voters should choose their politicians, not the other way around. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Remind us again just exactly what it is you're trying to accomplish.
We're trying to take the power of redistricting, drawing voting maps, and taking it away from the legislators that have something to benefit from drawing maps in their favor, and bringing it back to the people, letting it be a fair and transparent process that helps us have our votes counted instead of being manipulated.
And why are you doing this now?
You know, I think there's a lot of people, especially coming from the 2016 election, that just felt like our systems aren't fair. We went after two anti-establishment people in Michigan in the primaries. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both won. And I think that people, if we're getting candidates from the establishment that we don't like, maybe the establishment or the way things have been done isn't working. And so we felt like this was a good nonpartisan way of making our state more fair and hopefully having a lot more people listen to.
And the end goal of this state constitutional amendment would be what?
It would be to have an independent citizens commission that would draw the lines, meaning that everyday people who don't have anything to politically gain from manipulating the maps are helping make sure that our voting districts are fair and representative.
So governor, lawmakers, hands off.
Yes, exactly. Voters, not politicians.
Now, you have submitted proposed language for a voter petition to the Board of State Canvassers. What does that language say?
Yeah, so it's really creating an independent citizen commission, meaning that people from across our state can come together and create a fair and transparent process. It would invite public participation. It would make sure that there's diverse opinions being considered, and also in a way that people can actually participate. Currently, it's just legislators and the governor who really get a say. And this is also making it so that there could be no political advantage when drawing these lines. They should just be made to represent our communities, not to make sure that one political party can have an unfair advantage to the other.
So you have submitted this proposed language, but and you're waiting for approval from the Board of State Canvassers before you begin collecting signatures?
Yeah, you get like a staff approval first, and then the Board of Canvassers will hold a meeting, and that's when we will find out if they've liked our form. We made sure all the font sizes were correct and that we included all the correct parts of the Constitution.
And you need over 315,000 signatures. Boy, that's a tall order.
It is. But actually, you know, it was something that we were really intimidated. We started actually from a Facebook post with a big random group of strangers who have quickly become this network of really empowered, amazing citizens. And when we started doing the math, we have over 6,000 people who've actually signed up to be circulating petitions. And when you break that down, you know, even if everybody just got 9 signatures a week, we could actually finish in about 16 weeks. And that's ahead of schedule and on the ballot with all volunteer power.
You have been going all around the state listening to voters at town halls. What did you learn? What did you hear from people?
Yeah, so a big part of our process when we were deciding on what should this constitutional language look like was we want to hear what people want. We're tired of being told, you know, what's the right solution? Why don't we actually have the people of Michigan, anybody who wants to, help craft this language? And what we heard is people are tired of not being listened to. We heard that people do not trust the current system, and they don't trust that even if they have an elected representative that they think would do the best job, that they wouldn't take an unfair advantage for political gain. We see a lot of people who are frustrated and feel like their voices aren't listened to, and actually even a lot of people who are really skeptical that any change can help. But what we also saw are so many people who are ready, especially to unite around something that is nonpartisan, that they don't have to be afraid about talking about at the holiday, you know, over the dinner table, and that can really be brought to and for the people of Michigan.
Now, have we seen commissions like this drawn up in other states, and how has it fared?
Yeah. So we have. The one thing with redistricting is it only happens once every 10 years. So the actual political science data on how these commissions have fared is fairly recent. But the cool part is there have been commissions in states like California, in Iowa, in Arizona that have really helped us learn a lot on what gets higher people participating in the process, what creates a more fair system, and really what it shows is that even if you just take the power away from the politicians who are running in the elections that they're drawing the lines for the next round, that people want to do a fair job. They take it as a civic duty, and they really try and listen to their fellow statesmen and women and try and make the most fair maps that are representative of communities so that we can have a representative government. You can have somebody at the state level looking out for your community and what you believe in.
In fact, did the U.S. Supreme Court actually kind of gave a blessing to the one that was created in Arizona, didn't it?
They did. Yeah, the Supreme Court has a couple of really interesting cases coming up, especially with the Wisconsin case. What we found in the past is that especially when it comes to racial gerrymandering, that there's a decent precedent for saying this isn't okay. But it's how do you create a fair system that is really still the question, and why it's so important that we change our own state constitution to make it a fair system, to not have to be dependent on people who have something to gain from the system, to actually just let the people who are supposed to be the ones represented leading that charge.
Yeah, so knowing that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that Citizens Commission in Arizona could indeed take charge of a state's redistricting effort, that's got to be encouraging to you. And then the case from Wisconsin, you mentioned the court will be hearing a case, won't it?
Yes, it will. And it is very encouraging that Arizona has said, yes, people have the right and power to do this. In Wisconsin, what we're looking at is our first case of partisan gerrymandering, which means one political party or another looking at how people vote to try and disenfranchise them, to try and draw lines that either make their voice more powerful or less powerful. So it'll be very exciting because we do think that there is some evidence of partisan gerrymandering in Michigan that we want to help prevent in the future.
What would be the dream conclusion to all of this effort for you?
Yeah, I think the voters bringing this ballot initiative, it being created from people across our state, gathering signatures and letting people actually be a part of the political process to then instate this commission of people who can come together every 10 years to create something that is fair and looking out for every Michigander. Hopefully there's higher, you know, participation in elections because people actually feel listened to. Hopefully we're seeing more people wanting to get into the political arena so that they feel like people who support them could actually vote for them and have a say. I think really what we're just looking for is fairness and a system that we can trust.
And the next round of redistricting happens after the 2020 census. So you're looking at that 2021-22 legislative term. How confident are you that you'll have that citizens committee in place by then?
We're extremely confident. What we have seen is an uproar of people who are so excited and passionate to make this happen. You know, we see that people are sick of the status quo and that they see that there's a problem and that they can extend over personal political beliefs to want to do something that's better. So we are very excited. There's a lot of people who still need to hear about redistricting, but once they do, they understand and I think have personal experience with feeling like their beliefs aren't being reflected in Lansing and then in Washington.
Katie Fahey's president of the group's Voters Not Politicians, working to get a proposal to change how Michigan draws its legislative and congressional districts on the 2018 ballot. Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There is so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we can't possibly know about at all. And that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. So if you have a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, just send it along. Just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called the Fair Michigan Justice Project, a collaboration between the LGBT advocacy group Fair Michigan and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. And it marks an important new approach in pursuing hate crimes committed against people who are LGBT. And we wanted to get a one-year report card as we welcome Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy. Such a pleasure to welcome you to
my
Stateside.
My pleasure to be here.
And from Fair Michigan, we have Attorney and President Dana Nessel.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Special Prosecutor for the Fair Michigan Justice Project, Jamie Powell Horowitz. So good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Dana, what drove you to come up with this idea? What was not working?
What I had seen, unfortunately, over the course of many years was what seemed to be a large number of hate crimes that were being committed against the LGBTQ community. And personally, I was getting a lot of complaints from people who were saying that they didn't feel like they were adequately protected by the criminal justice system and that they were very afraid to report these crimes. And they felt that the crimes were going not just that they were not reporting them, but that they were not being properly investigated when they did report them. They were not being solved. They were not being prosecuted. And it seemed as though this was an area where there was a real need for some reform.
And Kim, what is it that you weren't getting in order to pursue these crimes?
I was getting not really pushback, but I was reading about all these cases. And one day I asked the chief, had they been solved? What's happening with these cases? I knew, because I live close to Palmer Park, I knew that there had been a number of cases of missing African-American women of color, trans women, or killed, and many issues. And I checked, and I never saw any warrants come into my office. And I checked with my warrants, and we didn't have any. And I knew I had personally heard of probably four or five at least. And maybe not that high, but I just remember hearing that.
And they stuck in your mind and
they
heart.
They stuck in my mind. Stuck in my mind, absolutely. And, you know, not only because they were LGBTQ, but because they were women of color. So I called the person that I knew would be able to help. She came up with the idea. I told her what the problem was. Mm-hmm. She's the one that came up with the solution. But the end game is that we decided to partner. And it's been more successful than I think any of us imagined.
So this collaboration, it really is pretty unique in the country, isn't it?
As far as I know, we're the only ones.
I think
Wayne County is the only county prosecutor's office that has a task force that operates the way that ours does.
So who's on the task force? So give us an idea of what it's about.
So what we decided to do is, through this collaboration, to have a task force that focused solely on hate crimes perpetrated against the LGBTQ community. So what we have is Jamie Powell Horowitz, who is a very well-recognized, well-respected prosecutor. So she's actually been assigned as a special prosecutor sworn in by Kim in her office so that she can prosecute these cases in Wayne County. We have a special investigator named Vicki Yost, who has decades of law enforcement experience, and she serves as our investigator. And then we also have a victim's advocate who's a trans woman by the name of Jaleesa Abad, and she worked with the victims in our cases, and she's really been our liaison to the trans community to assist us with getting cooperation from transgender victims and also trans witnesses.
And so, Jamie, here you are, the former assistant prosecutor in Wayne County, and now you're sworn in and you're devoted to this. So what are you able to do now through working with this project, with the Fair Michigan Justice Project, that maybe you couldn't before?
Well, one of the most important things about this project is that we are able to vertically prosecute the cases, which means that as soon as the crime happens, as soon as we are aware of it, we are able to have contact with the victim. We stay with them through the entire case. So they're only dealing with one prosecutor, one advocate. So they don't have a multitude of people calling them. They don't have to be re-victimized repeatedly by having to tell their story to somebody else every step of the way. So it's, I think, comforting for the victim to have one person to deal with. Jaleesa Abad is our trans advocate. I have to say she has been invaluable to us. A lot of our trans victims are so nervous about coming to court. Even for them to come through the front door and go through security, have to take their jewelry off, have to take off their belt, they feel that this is such a difficult place to come to have to tell their story. So to have somebody stand with them, hold their hand, stay with them throughout the process is very comforting. They know that there are law enforcement people who are on their side and that are going to help them through the process.
And then what are we getting in terms of the law enforcement side of things, where perhaps before a case was maybe put up on the, you know, in the cold file and kind of forgotten about? How is this changing that narrative?
I think it's getting better. Slowly but surely. And one of the big issues for me has always been not only with the LGBTQ community, but also with criminal justice, period, is there are certain segments of the people that I represent, and I represent all of the people of the state of Michigan, that just don't feel that the criminal justice system is for them, with them, cares about them. They feel that they're abandoned, ignored, and frankly, they're very afraid to be engaged, and they don't want to report horrible victimization. So
why? Help us understand why that is.
From either by the way they've been treated in the past, the way that they perceive they can be treated, the way they have been, actually, people have been treated, people of color, women with the rape kits. That's a whole thing behind the rape kits, is they were totally ignored. And this project addresses that. And we had many things that Dana and I and Jamie talked about is where we're going to do the interviewing, how we're going to do it, how we're going to be involved. Chief Craig was one of the first people we talked to. And he was on board. I believe we're working with some other departments. So slowly but surely, I think people are coming around, and a lot of people aren't, but I think people are at least beginning to realize that everybody deserves justice. They may not agree with the way we're doing it. They may not agree with a lot of things. I really think that people are coming around to the idea that everybody in the county of Wayne, everywhere, deserves justice. And we're just trying to give them a measure of justice that makes them feel recompensed somehow, makes them feel that they do matter, that makes them feel that going forward their cases are going to matter. And it helps us in the end because we want people to come forward. We want people to report any abuse, any victimization, any crime that happens to them. And hopefully, if nothing else, that's what's happening here.
Yeah, you know, the very first case that we did last summer in July, right after this project was formed, I think it was a week after Dana and Kim had started talking about putting this project together, there was an individual who posted on social media. He posted himself assaulting an LGBTQ man with a weapon, and he was spewing homophobic slurs. He posted online. This victim really highlights why this project was so important. This victim did not tell anyone. He did not tell his family. He did not tell his friends. He did not go to law enforcement. It was posted online. It caught the attention of Danny Woods, the Detroit Police Department, who is the liaison for the LGBT community. And we worked with her. Jaleesa Abad started making contacts in the community with people that she knew. We ultimately located him, and he talked to us about it. He did not want to go to the police. He did not want to talk about it to anybody but us.
But you created that safe space.
So we didn't make him come in. We went to him, and we gave him a safe space, and he was able to successfully come forward. And This was such a sad case because this victim, after being victimized, was actually told to leave his own home and told that it was his fault that this happened to him because he was gay. So this really highlights why it's so difficult for victims to come forward. They don't have the support. They have no support system in place. Jaleesa Abad, our advocate, was able to get services for him. We stayed in touch with him throughout the case, and we were very pleased at the result we got. The defendant is now serving time in prison for the assault.
And this is a really dangerous person. I mean, he was not just dangerous to the LGBTQ community, but, you know, he made threats against the police. He is a person that Wayne County and the state of Michigan is a much safer place with him behind bars right now. And even though, the ironic thing is that even though he had captured this offense on videotape, we would not have been able to prosecute him without the testimony of the complaining witness.
Right.
And so having this tool, if you will, of the Fair Michigan Justice Project, you're getting what you need to be able to go forward.
There's no question about it. There's no question about that most of the cases on this list probably wouldn't have, maybe all of them wouldn't have been prosecuted but for this project. But the fact that people feel free to put online, to say, to brag about their abuse of other people, and we're seeing it all over. But especially in the last, I'd say, last couple of years, especially people seem emboldened to attack members of this community. And to me, it's outrageous and it's intolerable and we won't have it.
Well, let's talk about what kinds of convictions you've been able to get. How many in total in this first year?
At this point, in less than a year, we have 9 convictions.
And what are some of the cases?
We've had anything from criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, those rape cases, assault with intent to murder. We've had a few of those, shootings, stabbings, felonious assault cases. That's assault with a dangerous weapon. We even had an extortion case. We frequently see people who are targeted online. Many times, defendants or suspects will target individuals based on their sexual orientation, lure them in with the promise of a romantic encounter, and then they will rob them, assault them, steal from them. We even had one suspect that we charged and prosecuted who actually came to meet our victim wearing latex gloves. And when the victim refused to get into the car, the defendant shot him twice in the back. while making homophobic slurs.
I'm wondering, as we are aware of national and local stories over these past couple of years about these cases you're talking about, the crimes against transgender people in Detroit, how would you characterize what the transgender community is facing in Detroit and in Wayne County?
Well, you know, what I can say about that is all of the LGBTQ community faces obstacles. I think that the trans community really has it the worst. And something that I had suspected, but then my fears were confirmed through our work in this project, is that a lot of people who are victimized, who are trans, are victimized specifically because they are left in a place where they're much more vulnerable than the rest of the population. Because we don't have any protections for sexual orientation or gender identity in our Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, or even in the Ethnic Intimidation Act, which is our state hate law act, it leaves them more vulnerable. So you'll see a lot of trans people who, because they cannot get jobs, because it's difficult for them to get safe housing, they're left in a place where oftentimes they're on the street. And people who are on the street are going to be targeted more for violent offenses. And so you cannot fail to see the connection between the lack of protection in our state laws and the crimes that are being committed against the community. And, you know, when Kim talks about all of these murders or very serious assaults against trans women of color in the city of Detroit, I don't think that Detroit is inherently less safe than other major cities, but a lot of those other cities are in states that have protections. So a lot of these trans folks are able to get employment because they cannot be discriminated against. And unfortunately, that's not the case here in the state of Michigan. So the other thing that these laws tend to do is, by not protecting these very marginalized classes of people, it really sends a message to these offenders and to these perpetrators of these crimes that maybe mm-hmm. these classes of the people aren't as deserving of legal protections as all other people. And it emboldens them to commit crimes against these people because the message is, the state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're gay. The state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're trans.
What's really interesting, though, is that the state of Michigan does require reporting to the Michigan State Police. The Michigan State Police then publishes their statistics to federal authorities. But we are required to keep stats of hate crimes involving sexual orientation. We don't include gender identity, but we do include sexual orientation. So while the state of Michigan requires reporting of these crimes, there's no hate crime law to prosecute these hate crimes under. So it's very disjointed and it doesn't make any sense.
And the thing that has been of such great comfort to me is at least I can say, well, maybe the state of Michigan doesn't care about you, but Wayne County does.
Ken, what's being done, Kim, in Wayne County with you as the prosecutor and then with the whole team that Fair Michigan has put together, is that filtering out to the rest of the state? And are people paying attention who matter?
I'd like to say it is. There are some of my colleagues across the state, for example, that are very, very receptive and are, I think, are beginning to do things in their own counties. For example, Jamie wrote a transgender apology when it came to prosecutions and how they should be treated. We made it a policy in Wayne County, and then I shared that policy with my 82 other colleagues across the state. And I think there were about 5 or 6 now that are considering making it a part of their policy as well, and some that already have not a similar policy, but at least that philosophy. So I'm hoping they'll take that extra step and make it their policy.
It's a transgender interaction policy, which directs law enforcement personnel in their interactions with the transgender community. In Wayne County, we will always respect your gender identity. We will use proper pronouns. We will argue with the defense when they refuse to use proper pronouns. We will not allow our victims to come into court and be disrespected.
And what's great is actually, you know, the judges, almost uniformly that I've seen, have agreed.
They've been very receptive in Wayne County, yes.
And giving people the proper language to use is very important. You can't fight crime. You can't be good at your job if you are not respectful to your victims. We always tell the police officers that we talk to and train and the prosecutors, we understand that people have differences of opinion. However, you always have to be professional and respectful And it helps you to solve crime. It helps you to close cases,
which is what you want to do.
It helps you to get justice for these individuals. So being respectful is extremely important.
I'm wondering, Prosecutor Worthy, does being part of this project take anything out of your budget?
No, not right now.
No, she's smiling.
No. As a matter of fact, thank you for bringing that. That's a very important point.
Well, I would say that I would really like to thank the Wayne County Commission and specifically Commissioner Gary Warnchak, as well as Warren Evans, the county executive of Wayne County, because I know they've been working really hard to try to do whatever they can to make certain that we have adequate funding for this project. So that's something that they're working on, and we're expecting to see some funding hopefully coming from the county. Up until this point, it's all been private funding. It's been a lot of speeches on my behalf.
It's like a campaign. That's what it is.
I would liken it to Kim's efforts to secure funding to test the Detroit rape kits. And so, you know, I've taken a page out of her book to the extent that sometimes the system you have in place simply isn't working for whatever reason. You have to be willing to try to take innovative measures that haven't been done before in order to solve the problem. At the end of the day, the goal is to try to solve these crimes, try to protect the community. And that's what projects like this aim to do and have been successful in doing.
What I tell people all the time, I'm supposed to represent the people of the state of Michigan. It doesn't say I represent just the straight people of the state of Michigan. I represent everybody. And everybody has a right to be heard and to be given justice. And those that need help getting there, we have to have projects like this. And so when you talk about Detroit that was bankrupt a few years ago, the county of Wayne that had no money and had problems a few years ago that's coming out of that. So you can't tell any. You certainly can't tell me that you can't do anything with no resources. It's persistence. It's having friends that are willing to step out there who have great ideas and who are willing to work hard and try to get things done in a less than conventional way.
And, Dana,
and it can be done.
The fact that this is really one of perhaps the only program of its kind in the nation, you have to have activists, LGBTQ activists across the country who would want to hear what you're doing and maybe replicate it in their states.
That was one of our big goals. And I know that Kim said from the very beginning that not only did we hope this was successful for Wayne County, which it has been, but we hope that this idea will spread to areas around the country. But As a person who is an LGBTQ person in Michigan, in a state that hasn't always made me feel so welcome, quite honestly, I am so proud to both live and work in Wayne County.
I want to grow up in a world where this isn't even an issue, that, you know, every person that does in law enforcement, every prosecutor that does these cases, the advocates have less to do, although there'll always be more. But that's the kind of world I want my children to grow up. I'm not going to grow up in that kind of world. But I want my children to grow up in that kind of world.
And this is a big start to this.
This is a start. And it's an example to children everywhere, I think. And I have to say that I'm very, very proud of this project. I'm proud of my government as well. And I think there's a whole lot more that we can give and a whole lot more that we can do as we get even more and more resourced.
The Fair Michigan Justice Project is celebrating its one-year anniversary. To mark that anniversary, we've been speaking with Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy and attorney and Fair Michigan President Dana Nessel and the Special Prosecutor for the Fair Michigan Justice Project, Jamie Powell Horowitz. Thanks to all of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Josh Hakala. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.